Sure, it's good to see all of you this morning, and we're very thankful to God for this great privilege to be together and study from the Word of God and study into areas we don't usually go into, and always nice to find the treasures that are hidden. I appreciate the congregation here for hosting this study. I appreciate that very much. Thanks to the elders and to Joshua for all the good work you've done on this. Appreciate all the sisters have done for us and making sure we don't go hungry. Our subject today is the one you've all been looking forward to. Between the Testaments. What happened between Malachi and Matthew? Why is there a 400-year period of silence? It works. Well, here's what happened between the two Testaments. Two world empires fell, and two arose. That's kind of a big deal. The Hellenization of the empire got underway and was fairly effective. The development of the Pharisees and the Sadducees takes place at this time, and that's helpful when we study the New Testament to know something about their background. Languages changed and evolved just as they always do, and of course that's significant to us because the Jews go from Hebrew to a different kind of a language, which has definitely been influenced by the Greek culture. And that, of course, brings us to the Septuagint, a new translation of the Old Testament from a different source, apparently, than the traditional Hebrew scriptures, but pretty accurate. And the Septuagint is the one that Jesus and the apostles quoted from quite a bit. So that's significant. We also have the apocryphal writings. They take place at this during this period of time. And we will be talking about the Apocrypha tomorrow, Lord willing. And then there's the Feast of Dedication, or the Feast of Lights. People today call it Hanukkah. But this was a feast that Jesus took part in, and this had its beginnings in this 400-year period of silence. And we have the Maccabean Revolt, which we will talk about. We'll talk about all of these things, but these are the things that you can take with you from the 400-year period of silence. These are significant things that will affect the Jews and will, of course, affect the whole world. If you're like me, you probably looked at this 400-year period of time with some indifference. And that's understandable because we know that the Old Testament is inspired by God, and anything between Malachi and John the Baptist is uninspired. So from that standpoint, we tend to think, well, it's probably not too important what happened then. But as you can see just from these highlights that I picked out, there were several things that happened in this period of time that are pretty significant and helpful for us to know, especially when we go to understand try to understand things in the New Testament. Anyone have any other highlight to add here? Any that you can think of from your study of this time? Yeah, that's good. The scattering of the synagogues. We'll touch a little bit on that, but that's a good point, Lewis. The scattering of the synagogues, which scatters the knowledge of God. Now, that's an important one. I'd put that one down on your list if you're taking notes. And that, of course, goes along with that phrase we hear in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 15, where the brethren at Jerusalem say, Moses is read in every city. Wherever there was a synagogue, people had been hearing the law of Moses. And that was one of the reasons they said we should be careful about eating things that are strangled, eating blood, because people are aware of the law of Moses. Very good. Any other highlights? I went backwards. All right. Just think for a moment. Why was there 400 years of silence? Why not have prophets come during that 400-year period of time? Why stop at Malachi? And, of course, when we say silence, we don't mean nothing happened. We just mean as far as inspiration, there were no oracles from God, nothing further after Malachi. The question is, was there a need for further revelation? And, of course, I think all of us would say, no, not really. Don't y'all like the book of Malachi? Malachi is just a great stepping off place and a great connector to the New Testament. It ends with John the Baptist, and then Mark's Gospel starts with John the Baptist. So, again, another reason why we may not think too much about this 400-year period, because we've got the connection right there. There's no real need, as far as I can see, for any further revelation during that time. And then this last question I would ask is, what good would it have accomplished to give further revelation? How well did the prophets in the Old Testament do as far as being received by the people? Not very well, did they? We all remember what Stephen said when he was speaking to the Jews in Acts 7. He said, which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? It's a great question. But it's very sad and tragic as well, because it shows that they did not want to hear. That it proved his charge that they were stiff-necked and uncircumcised heart and ears. And they literally did that when Stephen was speaking to them. They didn't like to hear it. They wanted to believe that they were keeping the law of God, and yet their actions and their hearts, for the most part, there's a remnant, there was exceptions, but for the most part, they didn't want to hear God. They didn't want to hear his prophets. So God said what he needed to say. He got us ready for Jesus to come and told us that there would be a messenger to prepare us for that, and that did indeed happen when we begin to read the New Testament. Anyone have any other thoughts on why God would have been silent for 400 years? Eldon? Yeah, interesting thought. Eldon says possibly it could have stirred the curiosity of the Jews and caused them to look forward to something better, and also that they hadn't really received the ones before. Yeah, that's interesting. Thomas? That's a good question. I've wondered that too. Thomas's question is, we have no recorded inspiration. Does that mean there was no inspiration? And that's a good, interesting thought. I don't know. When we talk about the Apocrypha, there is debate over whether any of that was inspired or not. But as far as I can see, I haven't seen any evidence of anything that was inspired that was not recorded. But of course, that would be kind of hard to prove, too, you know. It's kind of like proving a negative or something like that. But it is a good question. I've thought about it, but I don't really have a good answer on that one. Very good. Thank you, Rick. Good. Rick points out that Amos prophesied about a famine of the Word of God, and that this is reference to the 400-year period of silence. Thank you, Rick. That's good. I wanted us to think for a little bit about Nehemiah, the 13th chapter, which would we all agree that was basically the last part of Old Testament history? Anyone have anything that would be after Nehemiah as far as his history that we have recorded? Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess you could say that Malachi was speaking in a historical context. Yeah. Esther would have taken place, I believe, before this passage in Nehemiah. But she definitely comes towards the end of recorded Old Testament history. But I just wanted to notice these points, basically 4 points from Nehemiah 13, because these are sins and problems that will be a problem for the children of it, for the Jews, throughout the 400-year period. And it's something I think we can all make applications to ourselves, that these are things that we have to fight against too. And when you read the first 9 verses, you read about how they had been mingling and mixing with the foreigners, the ones who didn't truly love the Lord, and that was going to be a problem for them. And so he... verse 3 says, "So it was when they had heard the law that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel." And it talks about how Tobiah, one of the enemies of Israel, had prepared a room for himself in the courts of the house of God. And Nehemiah was grieved bitterly, verse 8, "Therefore I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room." Reminds me of Rick talking last night about what John is said to have done when he went into the public bath and there was Cerinthus there, and he left. He didn't want anything to do with him. That's not really acceptable behavior in the eyes of a lot of people, but I think according to the Bible, there's times when that's what's called for, to separate ourselves that drastically from those who are evil. And then the next point in Nehemiah 13 is the house of God had been forsaken. So he contended with the rulers of verse 11 after realizing that the Levites hadn't got their portions and the singers who worked with them had gone back to their field. So I contended with the rulers and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And I gathered them together and set them in their place. And then they straightened up for at least a while. Do we have trouble with the house of God being forsaken today? No. Still a problem. Men tend to go off into their own business and their own pleasures, and as a result, the church is forsaken. And some go as far as to stop coming to church. They don't even care about that. And what's really sad is when they stop coming to church and they still act like they are serving God. "Oh, I still pray to God. I still read my Bible." Which part are you reading? They're forsaking the house of God. And I always like the contrast to that in the story of Josiah. The reason Josiah did so well was because he didn't forsake the house of God. He made the commandment, we need to fix the house of God, the physical house of God. We need to pay attention to that and make sure it's kept up, maintain it. And it was while they were maintaining it that they found the copy of the law. And they were wise enough to bring that to King Josiah. And when he read it, it changed everything, didn't it? And it's all because he didn't forsake the house of God. He said, we need to take care of this. So that's a good lesson for us to take care of the church. And this is going to be a challenge for the Jews during the 400-year period of time to keep up the house of God. I sure like verse 14, and we'll see the similarities in the rest of the chapter. Nehemiah says, remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I've done for the house of my God and for its services. See, that's the plea of a beggar, isn't it? That's the plea of someone who's poor in spirit. Isn't that interesting? This is a poor man who's poor in spirit, and yet he does things for God. He doesn't say, oh, well, I can't do anything. That's not what it means to be poor in spirit. It means that you realize I'm weak, but I've got to do what's right. So please remember me, God, for what I've done. I've tried. I've really tried to do what's right. And that's the plea we should all have, too, is that we want to do what's right. And it, you know, when you read this chapter, it seems like Nehemiah is kind of alone, doesn't it? Doesn't talk about how this brother came to help me, but that people came around, but it seems like Nehemiah is kind of alone in his fight. The last two in Nehemiah 13, the breaking of the Sabbath, verse 17 and 18, you profane the Sabbath day. You bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. They were doing all kinds of things, just doing all kinds of merchandising, commercialization. It was time to buy and sell and get gain on the Sabbath day. And the Sabbath, of course, was something God wanted them to remember, to take time out, to rest, even as God rested from His work on the Sabbath day. Verse 22 again, remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. He did bring them back to keeping the Sabbath. And then the last one, this is a real important one, especially good for you young men to remember, those of you that haven't married yet. I saw in verse 23 the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half the children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. See, the problem with a mixed marriage, a spiritual mixed marriage, what are the children going to be? You might be able to maintain your faith, but what about your children? If they've got you to look at and they've got your spouse to look at, which one are they going to pick? It seems that in a lot of cases, the children will choose the easier course. And if Sunday morning, mom doesn't go to church, or dad doesn't go to church, that's more easy to follow, isn't it? So this is the problem with the mixed marriages. So verse 25, Nehemiah contended with them and cursed them. Struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons. That's pretty drastic, isn't it? What would you think of somebody that operated that way today in the church? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I know. He is the leader of the people, the secular or civil leader at least, and he's also got this spiritual perspective on things. This is, yeah, I know, Thomas. I try to picture it because it's so different than today. If any elder did this in a congregation, it seems like everybody'd turn on him. You know, anybody else who heard about it would turn on him and say, what are you treating people like that for? You don't treat people this way. But this doesn't this show us how serious the subject is? He didn't just pick out a little minor issue. This was an important issue. Who you get married to. It's the second most important thing you ever do. And so it does deserve serious consideration. Be careful. Grant? Ruth, the Moabitess. Yeah. That's good. I think the difference, the way I'd understand this, Grant, is that here in Nehemiah, they're marrying women and they don't change. But in the case of Ruth, she showed loyalty and that my God, your God will be my God. So that's a good point. That's important to remember. This doesn't mean that there's nobody outside of the church that you can marry. It just means that before you get married, you need to be sure that you're on the same page spiritually. And I don't think they were doing that here. They were just... They were doing what they did in the days of Noah. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair. They looked good. And that is not the priority. It's not the priority. I was reading about... reading about Cleopatra. What's Cleopatra known for? Her beauty. But if you've ever seen any of the images of her, she's not that pretty. She's got a big nose. Somebody said that if her nose had been smaller, the whole world would have been changed. But where her beauty was, I mean, she wasn't bad to look at, but she wasn't what you would first of all think, oh, whoa. But she was very beautiful. But what made her beautiful was they said she was very agreeable, she was very pleasant, she had a nice voice, and she just had a great personality. That's why she was able to get in with world leaders, was she just, her beauty was really on the inside. She was a nice person to be around. And that's why men fell for her. It wasn't so much that she was the most beautiful woman of her day, physically. She had the true qualities of beauty in her own way. And so that's what men have to remember too when they get married, is that you need to marry somebody who really is beautiful. That means they're beautiful inside, and that makes them nice to be with and pleasant to talk to. But again, we're not advocating this kind of behavior, but it does emphasize what an important issue this is. Why God said, don't marry these women because they will cause you to sin. They will cause you to do what Solomon did. Solomon, the great king, and yet when he didn't heed the advice, look what happened to him. Any other comments on Nehemiah 13? I just thought that was an interesting chapter, being the last of the history of Israel, to show that they're still got problems. We don't leave them. Oh, everybody's good. Everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. No, they're not doing what they're supposed to do. But if you have a man like Nehemiah, he can help to bring about a change. Yes, Eldon. Okay. That's exactly right. Solomon is the example Nehemiah uses, and it's certainly a good example. Solomon and Samson. Solomon, wisest, and yet women got him to sin. Samson, strongest, and women got him to sin. I'm not as strong as Samson. I'm not as wise as Solomon, so I'd better pay attention to that. Well, let's think for a moment about the Medo-Persian Empire, because it's going to it's where we leave the children of Israel at the end of the inspired writings of the Old Testament. And it's interesting to think that Daniel, Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah all lived under the rule of the Medo-Persians. For the most part, they were favorable to the Jews. They helped things. They helped the Jews on different occasions. It was the decree of Cyrus that enabled the children of Israel, the Jews, to rebuild the temple, and there was goodwill there for in many cases. And as Lewis said, they helped to spread things out, and the Greeks would help that to some extent, but the Persians helped it a lot. We have one example of that, Daniel chapter 6, after Daniel is rescued from the lion's den. Just note this, because Darius, the king, wrote this decree to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell on the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. His dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lion. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So this was to be sent throughout the empire. The knowledge of God was being spread. People must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. It's interesting, isn't it, how God worked with these world empires. Before this, remember how he worked with Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar was so powerful, and yet God kept him humble, and in a drastic way, because Nebuchadnezzar was higher than any of us could ever be. None of us have a world empire that could go to our heads. We have other things that go to our heads, but it doesn't lift us up as high as Nebuchadnezzar. And I think that's why Nebuchadnezzar had to be brought so low. When you and I are brought low and humbled, we don't have that far to fall, because we can't get very high. It seems high far to us, but Nebuchadnezzar had a long way to fall. And he fell way down to be like the cattle of the field. And that eventually he came to his senses and realized that it's the God of heaven who rules. It's not me. It's the God of heaven who rules. So that's an amazing story. And so it's good to see King Darius learned. You know, he was not nearly as puffed up as Nebuchadnezzar had been. And he learned that this God of Daniel, we need to fear him and respect him. Any comments on the Medo-Persian Empire? Here's the extent of the Persian Empire, which shows, you know, if Darius sent this decree out, this went all over the world, basically, didn't it? I mean, it covered a great portion of it. Almost gets to India. And goes down into Egypt and Libya. Goes into a little bit of Europe. So that was quite a dissemination of the knowledge of God. This Persian Empire.